Ms. Saghafi would tell Imam Khomeini that many of the people who express warm sentiments on the street might not be his lovers, and they might be ill-wishers who wanted to exploit the sentiments of masses. The Imam would answer, "Yes, some of these people may be such, but most of them who gather on the streets and alleys are the downtrodden and barefooted people of society who will abandon us if we do not appreciate them. What is important for us is not to forget ourselves and not be boastful of this popular bounty, or else we will both lose them and be the losers of the field of divine obligation." Imam Khomeini's wife would receive many guests during her stay in Qom with the Imam. Thousands of ladies were eager to meet the lady. Relatives, old friends, and acquaintances from Tehran, Qom, Mahallat, and Khomein, the ladies from the houses of the sources of emulations and great ulema in Qom, the wives of the officials and women and girls working at different organs, and ladies from all over Iran would come to Qom to visit the Imam's wife, and she would receive them warmly, even if they had come with no early informing. Imam Khomeini and his wife stayed in Qom for 9 months. Dear listeners, we will speak about the events during this period in the next episode.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Al Jazeera recently screened a four-part investigation into the subversion of the Labour Party by opponents of Jeremy Corbyn, who was the leader of the party from 2015 to 2019. What can we learn from this unprecedented leak of internal files? In today's programme, I'll be speaking to experts to tease out the significance of the leaks and to see if we can finally answer the question, who killed the Corbyn project? But first, we've got this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra on how Jeremy Corbyn was undermined.
The news channel Al Jazeera obtained the largest leak of documents in British political history. The internal emails of the Labour Party revealed scandal upon scandal. The Labour File series of documentaries showed an internal party bureaucracy which worked relentlessly against both the membership and specific political figures who were supportive of the Jeremy Corbyn leadership. Much of this was fixated on demonising supporters of Palestine and disqualifying them from membership of the party. Evidence of false allegations of homophobia to force support for Corbyn's competitor, Angela Eagle, started as early as 2015. Members were mercilessly smeared with untrue claims. Was this a test run for the fake anti-Semitism crisis which helped bring down Corbyn? Another episode in the series showed the head of internal governance in the Labour Party, Claire Frances Fuller, joking about stabbing Jeremy Corbyn in a WhatsApp group with other Labour staff. She was not held accountable and is now senior communications manager at the British NHS. Another scene in the same episode shows Ben Westerman, an investigations officer at the Labour Party, lying as part of a BBC Panorama episode with the aim of smearing a Labour Party member. It also reveals Labour councillor Izzy Lenger twisting an example of previous alleged anti-Semitism at university and projecting it onto the Labour Party to create a false impression. It was, of course, not mentioned that Lenger trained with the Israeli military. She entered through the Marva training program, which Palestine Declassified has previously pointed out can be accessed through the Union of Jewish Students. The series also shows Dan Fox, the head of Labour Friends of Israel and partner of Labour Blairite MP Stella Creasy, cavorting with Islamophobes. Dan Fox fought as a British soldier in Afghanistan, and we can reveal that he is still part of British military intelligence. The series also shows the party functionaries spying on local membership in the borough of Newham. They stalked members and collected private information on them for the purpose of investigation. The surveillance of these members then aided the party in expelling them. Evidence of Labour hacking the emails of a local newspaper in Croydon was also revealed. The series denuded the party as a criminal conspiracy against its own members. The Labour Party functions not as an expression of its members' will, but as a surveillance system repressing Labour in the interests of capital. It is a weapon in the British establishment's class war toolbox. It was before, during, and after the Corbyn era. The party appears to be concerned with narrowing rather than broadening political participation. But the Labour files are also an indictment of the political and media culture of the country as a whole. A conscious decision was made at the highest level of the Corbyn-led party to appease enemies of progress, thus sacrificing members and long-time allies in the hope that those forces of regression might grant some respite. They didn't, and thousands have suffered. Today, Palestine Declassified will delve into how exactly the party was captured by key Israel lobby groups.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Amar Kazmi. Amar is an anti-imperialist political activist and he's just finished his master's degree in law. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and also worked as my communications officer in my parliamentary office. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. The initial purge of the Labour Party members focused on suspending people who'd criticised right-wing MPs. Was that why they didn't want to deal with anti-Semitism cases, do you think?
It kind of looks a little bit like that. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that they spent an awful lot of effort trying to find critics of these right-wing MPs, some of whom were Zionists, but not all. I mean, quite a lot of them were just the normal right-wingers in the party. Mm. So it looks like they didn't really get that anti-Semitism was the big issue that was coming, and instead they wanted to spend their time doing something else, which is an interesting thing to see, because it suggests that it was only later that the whole question of anti-Semitism became the defining feature of the attack on Corbyn. Mm.
Amar, if I could turn to you now. I mean, what do you know about these external organisations like Labour Against Anti-Semitism and Nashe Jew, who were behind an avalanche of complaints?
Well, these groups played a pivotal role in not only harassing pro-Palestine activists and people who were close to Jeremy Corbyn, but also in generating a narrative that the Labour Party was full of so-called anti-Semites. They operated predominantly on Twitter. They would post screenshots of, you know, activists saying very innocuous things, nothing anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish at all, and claiming that this was some sort of major crisis in the party. And of course, because staff in the Labour Party and in the leader's office and people around Jeremy Corbyn were very obsessed with Twitter, in my opinion, they then had a sort of inflated view of how big, let's say, the quote-unquote problem was in the Labour Party. And so one way that they would try to generate this narrative that the Labour Party was full of bigots was by, you know, being trolls on Twitter. Yeah. But they would have another strategy, which is they would directly get in contact with the Labour Party, send them deluges of screenshots and posts, asking them to take action against Labour Party members. They would also send press releases and files and information to right-wing hacks in the mainstream media. And we know that this was a concerted operation, sometimes by a very small group of individuals. You know, 23% of all the complaints around so-called anti-Semitism originated from a single complainant. 12% originated from one group, Labour Against Anti-Semitism, right, which is run by people, many people who are not even Jewish. Mm. Denny Taylor, the person who founded it. Ewan Phillips, the spokesperson. Emma Pickin, one of its most prominent activists. None of these people are Jewish. It was a very concerted operation. And they had lots of influence.
Yes, tiny number of people responsible for lots and lots of complaints. David, I mean, what do you make of the Board of Deputies waiting until 2020, their 2020 trustees report, to quietly acknowledge their close working relationship with the Israeli embassy? I mean, it wasn't mentioned in any of the trustees' reports during Jeremy Corbyn's tenure as leader. I mean, is that significant in any way, do you think?
Well, it's significant in the sense that we now know from the Labour files, the leaked material, that the Board of Deputies was actually regularly supplying to the party lists of people who it wanted suspended or expelled from the party. So it was deeply into this whole process, along with the troll accounts that, that Amar has been talking about. Mm. So they were doing this all the way through this process, and that's really significant in itself. And of course, that's a part of the strategy which was adopted by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel. So it may well be that they felt that it was easier to put that information out by 2020, and when they didn't have so much pressure on them, and they were able to fess up to that. But it's clear that all the way through they were operating with the same agenda, which was to attack people who were Corbyn supporters and to get them removed from the party on spurious grounds.
No, indeed. It's interesting, because previous Al Jazeera documentary that the lobby showed that there was also a close working relationship between the Israeli embassy and the Jewish Labour movement, wasn't there? But Amar, I mean, what about the role of internal groups like the Jewish Labour movement that I've just mentioned there? I mean, who were effectively a sort of fifth column in Labour's ranks during Corbyn's tenure, wasn't there?
Well, there were many internal groups. There was Progress, Labour First, Labour Friends of Israel, all of these groups were responsible for helping to subvert Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. In terms of the Jewish Labour movement specifically, I mean, they're an openly Zionist pro-Israel organisation. They used to be called Pa'ulet Zion, which means the workers of Zion. Basically, if you're Jewish and you're not a Zionist, if you don't support Israel, you can't really be a member of the Jewish Labour movement. Yeah, it was refounded actually in 2015 by a man called Jeremy Newmark, who had previously been found to have made false allegations of anti-Semitism against the university and college union. He specifically refounded it. This was also revealed in Al Jazeera's 2017 documentary, The Lobby, in order to fight Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, this is what the Jewish Labour movement was specifically set out to do, to fight pro-Palestine activism, to promote the state of Israel.
The Jewish Labour movement particularly were pushing the anti-Semitism agenda, and obviously very, you know, unhappy about kind of pro-Palestinian activism. And you mentioned there are a number of other groups like Progress and so on. I mean, were they sort of piggybacking, do you think, on the back of sort of groups like the Jewish Labour movement who were kind of using anti-Semitism? That's what it looked like to me. I mean, what's your take on that?
There was definitely lots of piggybacking. I would say there was also lots of cross-pollination in terms of activists and personnel between these organisations. Right. So between, you know, for example, let's look at Labour First, which is, you know, headed by Luke Akhurst. Mm. He is an Israel lobbyist. He's the director of We Believe in Israel. So all of these groups in some way had a pro-Israel slant, and there was lots of
With innocuous names as well. It's interesting, you know, and then they're using it for, you know, for nefarious activities. But David, I mean, what can you tell us about the internal competition between the Israeli embassy and the Ministry of Strategic Affairs during this time? I mean, leaked documents imply that the embassy was uncomfortable about some of the ministry's activities with the Israel lobby groups.
It wasn't only the embassy. It was some elements of the Zionist movement in the UK were uncomfortable about this because, of course, what the ministry was planning to do was to put covert money into pro-Israel groups who would then campaign against Corbyn or some similar areas. And the worry was in the embassy and indeed in some Zionist groups that this would be illegal and that they would be found out and that the charity status would be threatened. So there was a worry about that, and that led to some groups, it seems, not taking the money, while other groups we know, like Sussex Friends of Israel or Northwest Friends of Israel, did take the money straight from the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. So there was a bit of a conflict there.
Right, OK. Well, let's just pause there for a moment, because we've got a report now about how some of Jeremy Corbyn's closest advisers conspired against him.
The hidden truth about the Labour files is the opposite of the view advanced by critics. They say that party leader Jeremy Corbyn interfered to slow down the progress of anti-Semitism cases. The truth was he speeded them up massively. The number of expulsions over anti-Semitism rose exponentially once Corbyn appointed a new general secretary in April 2018. In 2019, there were 45 expulsions. In 2017, there had only been one. Was this because of a widespread and increasing problem of anti-Semitism in the party? No. All the evidence shows that levels of anti-Semitism were lower than in society in general. The Corbyn-led party took over and extended the witch hunt by internalizing Zionist talking points on anti-Semitism. Three people were appointed to deal with complaints. Each had drunk the anti-Semitism Kool-Aid. Harry Habel says he learned about anti-Semitism on the left by reading two books, both by Zionists. Patrick Smith, a former member of the AWL, who complained that members of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign were essentially mad. And Laura Murray, who developed her understanding of anti-Semitism working with Zionist stakeholders and undertook an Israeli government-sponsored training on ancient and pernicious anti-Semitic tropes. This was a recipe for a dramatic escalation of the anti-Semitism witch hunt, with no basis on any rational or factual assessment of racism against Jews. In addition, Corbyn surrounded himself with advisors who were soft on Zionism or were Zionists. Momentum, the so-called hard-left Corbyn supporters, was set up by John Landsman, who, though previously critical of Zionism, moved to support the Zionist-produced IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism. He repeatedly said that the party had to regain the trust of the Jewish community. Another founder of Momentum was James Schneider. He met someone called Ben Judah, a Zionist, at Oxford, and acted in a play he co-wrote in 2008. It involved the inevitable Arab terrorist who turns out to be anti-Semitic. The pair were housemates in the period when Schneider founded Momentum and remain friends today. Judah did his bit for the witch hunt between 2015 and 2019, and now works for the NATO lobby group, the Atlantic Council. Schneider went on to become Corbyn's spokesperson. Palestine Declassified understands that he was amongst the key people pushing the strategy of apologizing for alleged anti-Semitism. He argued that the ridiculous judgment of the EHRC should and must be implemented, and even highlighted what he thought were really good passages in a book by an employee of the Zionist extremist Community Security Trust. As the labor files and other key evidence shows, the bullets used to assassinate Corbyn were shaped and produced by the Zionist regime and carried to the scene of the crime by Zionist lobby groups, assets, and fronts. But the key proximate actors that delivered the coup de grace to Jeremy Corbyn were in his own office.
David, the film there suggests there was a kind of Zionist capture of the Corbynite leadership of the party. Do you think that's a legitimate observation?
Absolutely. I mean, what happened was that they kind of inculcated and took on board the key ideas of the Zionist critique of the Labour Party, which was that anti-Zionism is effectively anti-Semitism, and so that people who were actually in charge of all the complaints on anti-Semitism were actually, in their own mind, implementing the Zionist witch hunt. So that was the problem. They had been taken over. They'd been captured by that set of ideas. All the people in charge there were the same, and they were implementing what, in the end, were factually baseless conceptions to remove people from the party for nothing.
Mm. I mean, Amma, what about the role of John Landsman in the subversion of the Corbynite project? I mean, he was the owner of the supposedly pro-Corbyn Momentum group at the time, wasn't he?
Yes, I mean, the influence of John Landsman in pushing this nonsense about anti-Semitism was absolutely pivotal, I think. I have to say, I did kind of know John Landsman, worked with him a few times. At the time, I suppose I was a bit naive. You know, I didn't really quite understand his background or the role that he was playing. But this is a man who claims that he used to be a Zionist. I think he probably still is a Zionist. He worked on a kibbutz in Anakab, for example, in Palestine. So he's contributed in his own small way to the ongoing colonization of the Palestinian people. But in terms of, you know, what he did when he was working for Momentum, I mean, you know, he went to Israel, for example, to give a talk on Corbynism. He helped to marginalise anti-Zionist Jews in the Jewish Labour, Voice for Labour, by saying that they weren't really part of the Jewish community. So he was also assisting the Jewish Labour movement in policing who is the right kind of Jewish person. So, yeah, the role played by John Landsman was absolutely pivotal in normalising Zionism, normalising the State of Israel, and in attacking people for so-called anti-Semitism. Sure. He attacked the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. Yes, he attacked you, for example.
No, indeed, he did. I wouldn't beat yourself up too much about being naive. I think many, many people, me included, were very naive at that time about what was possible. But, David, I mean, what do you know about this organisation, the Alliance for Workers' Liberty? I mean, is it a formally pro-Zionist group? And what influence does it have on the wider left in Britain?
Well, it's not formally pro-Zionist. Some of them say that we're not Zionist, but their positions are pro-Zionist. Mm. And they have a conception of the world which leads them to support the State of Israel, and indeed to be quite strongly Islamophobic. I mean, this guy, Patrick Smith, who is one of the people involved in the the three people involved with the Labour Party in doing the anti-Semitism complaints. He left the AWL over the fact that they were too Islamophobic, and, right. And he still ended up, you know, taking decisions inside the Labour Party, removing people for ludicrous things. But it's had a wider influence. They have this kind of Zionist approach, but it's had a wider influence on the left more generally. So there are many people who are on the left post, I guess, 9/11, who have become involved with Zionist campaigns. So obvious people like David Hirsch, for example, who we've talked about in this programme before,
indeed, of course, yeah.
Who set up Engage, the anti-BDS campaign. Jane Ashworth was also involved in that campaign. She was formerly a socialist organiser, the predecessor of the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. Alan Johnson, who works for BICOM, the Israel lobby group, again, another member, former member of the AWL. So it's had an influence on a whole strata of left intellectuals, left Zionist intellectuals. And that's really quite limiting for the ability of people on the left to see what Zionism is.
Mm. Well, let me ask you about this guy, Harry Habel. I mean, is it true that... I mean, he's the guy, of course, that wrote the leaked Labour anti-Semitism report and made scores of complaints about anti-Semitism before, or when he was a leading staff member at Momentum. That's before he joined the anti-Semitism unit in the Labour Party. I mean, what about this?
Well, I mean, you've just said it. I mean, he was before he was actually formally charged working for the Labour Party and dealing with anti-Semitic complaints, he was making complaints himself. He made scores of complaints against people, some of whom weren't even members of the Labour Party. And most of the complaints, you know, were the kind of complaints which were of the sort which was thought to be problematic, i.e. largely anti-Zionist things. Now, he then ends up in that position. And if you look at the leaked report, which it seems he wrote, he certainly seems to have written the large biographical section on himself. I mean, he says, you know, one of the reasons he got the job was because he was making all these ridiculous complaints. So they had already, in employing him, had already taken a decision, effectively, that they were going to implement the witch hunt, and that was what this unit was for.
Yeah. I mean, Amma, would you say that the position of a pro-Palestine activist in Britain has become better or worse as a result of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom would be to say that it's got better because he, you know, people say that Corbyn gave a platform to, you know, people who stand in solidarity with Palestine. But I would say actually that it's had a net negative effect because it's, you know, the Corbyn leadership effectively helped to normalise Zionism. They took on Zionist talking points. And the damage of that is almost incalculable. People on the Labour left, you know, we see them now. They still continue to spout these Zionist talking points. Mm. They have these quite racist positions, actually, in respect of the settler colonial project that's taking place against the Palestinian people and on questions of, you know, anti-imperialism and Islamophobia. So in terms of that effect of giving legitimacy to these right-wing views, which I don't think were necessarily that prevalent or as prevalent on the pro-Palestine left in Britain beforehand, that's been an effect that's taken place because of Jeremy Corbyn. And Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, as we know, prosecuted the war against pro-Palestine activists. They took on the witch hunt on behalf of the Israel lobby.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that is a fact that that perhaps a lot of people aren't as fully aware of as they should be. But finally, David, I mean, some people argue that James Schneider and the Momentum leadership were actually part of a conspiracy against the membership and indeed Corbyn himself. I mean, is that suspicion credible, in your opinion?
I don't think that we have the evidence to suggest that. I mean, I think what seems to me to be the case is that they were under attack by the Zionists. They felt they had to do something about this anti-Semitism problem which was being encouraged. The perception which was being encouraged by the media. And what they wanted to do with that was they wanted to deal with all the complaints much more rapidly and efficiently and effectively. And they did do that. Mm. But what that meant was that in order to do that, they took on the ideas which were being... they were being berated with by the Zionists, and they started to expel huge numbers of people who weren't really guilty of anything. And so they started off by trying to defend themselves, and they ended up by doing the bidding of their enemies.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now as we are right out of time. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
Limelight. British Prime Minister Liz Truss finally resigned, as experts had predicted her collapse days and even weeks before. Liz Truss's legacy for Britain was a tanking pound, soaring inflation, and a seemingly inevitable recession. World media websites have analysed this issue and the economic challenges that face Britain. Stay tuned for the second part, please. UK Prime Minister Liz Truss announced her resignation after 6 disastrous weeks in office, during which her tax plan panicked the markets and her only party turned on her. She will be the shortest-serving prime minister in the UK history. That's a remarkably short time tell for Conservative members of Parliament to pick their 5th prime minister since 2016 Brexit referendum left the party deeply divided. Truss will remain in office in the interim. The Times of London and Daily Telegraph both report that Truss's predecessor, Boris Johnson, is expected to throw his hat in the ring just 3 months after resigning over a series of scandals. It's unclear if Johnson would be able to get enough parliamentary colleagues to support him. Leaders around the world reacted to Truss's resignation announcement, with President Biden saying it did not change the two countries' enduring relationship. The announcement, 45 days after taking office, followed a tumultuous day in which Home Secretary Suella Braverman resigned and several senior Conservatives called on Truss to do the same. This whole affair inexcusable. It is a pitiful reflection on the Conservative parliamentary party on every level, and it reflects very badly, obviously, on the government of the day. Senior Conservative MP Charles Walker fume to the BBC. Walker was speaking in the wake of a chaotic vote over fracking, which Truss supports but many Conservative MPs oppose. With Truss's lieutenants desperately pressing MPs to vote with the government, a chaotic scene played out in which the chief whip reportedly announced she was resigning and Truss left the chamber to chase after her, causing both to miss the vote. That episode seem to sum up Truss' short tenure. The website of Axios continued, the market panic had already forced Truss to fire her finance minister, a close ideological ally, and replace him with a more centrist figure in Jeremy Hunt. Hunt will be among the potential consensus picks to replace Truss, along with Rishi Sunak, who finished second to Truss in the leadership race, but correctly warned of the economic dangers of her tax cut plans. Other potential successors include Defence Minister Ben Wallace or House of Commons Leader Penny Mordaunt, though hardline Brexiteers like Braverman may also throw their hats in the ring. Truss won the intra-party race to replace Boris Johnson, by promising bold tax cuts, including for the rich, in order to boost economic growth. Truss dismissed claims that such a plan was highly risky given rising inflation and the UK's stretched fiscal circumstances, as Project Fear from the Anti-Growth Coalition. In fact, she announced the tax cut alongside massively expensive energy subsidies. That spooked the market so badly that the Bank of England staged an emergency intervention to ease a run on the pound. Unable to steady the situation, Truss took the humiliating step of handing economic policy over to Hunt. The situation further made clear that in jittery times like these, previously little-known risks in the financial system can bubble up seemingly from nowhere, with seismic economic and political consequences. Approval ratings for Truss and the Conservatives fell even faster than the pound. Polls now consistently put the Conservatives more than 30 points behind Labour. Remarkably, one new poll out this week finds that just 21% of 2019 Conservative voters would prefer Truss as Prime Minister to Labour leader Keir Starmer. There was anger toward Boris Johnson. With Liz Truss, it's more despair. People think she is not up to the job, says James Johnson, whose firm JL Partners has been conducting focus groups on Truss. No election is due for 2 years, but many Conservatives are already expecting to lose power for the first time since 2010, possibly in landslide. A lot of people have essentially already given up, Johnson says. Truss is eligible for a taxpayer-funded allowance of $129,000 annually for the rest of her life. The costs are a reimbursement of incurred expenses for necessary office costs and a secretarial cost arising from their special position in public life, per the government's website. A post-Brexit identity crisis has led the UK to what will be its fifth Prime Minister since the 2016 referendum.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This, in turn, is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us, and we welcome you to the club now. So if you could please explain for our audience in as much detail as possible, what is the current global financial situation dominated by the West that is now coming to an end? Some of the main features of it, some of those main issues as to this current situation, and how is it that we are now transitioning away from this current system and into a new system?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I shall try to explain the current situation from the viewpoint of the theory of long-term economic development. I am an expert in this long-term cycles theory, and the present situation is a situation of transition. The world is changing dramatically. It changes both technologically and institutionally. This time, we are going through two transitions. The first transition is technological revolution, the transition to the new technological mode, which means that the economy is suffering from the drastic changes in the technological structure. Each technological structure is the basis for the so-called Kondratiev long wave.
Yes.
These cycles have 50 years lengths, and every 50 years we have approximately technological revolution. This period is a period of depression in the economy, because the companies, especially in the developed countries, are suffering from the excess of capital in the obsolete industries. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to transfer capital from the obsolete industries to the new one. This transition started about 15 years ago, and now it is coming to the end. The new technological mode, which is based on nanotechnologies, information technologies, digital technologies, biotechnologies, bioengineering technologies, and now is formed, and its expansion is go on the with the accelerated growth. The growth rate of this new technologies is about 35% per year. At the same time, we are going through the institutional change. This changes are taking place in with much more longer periods. The Italian scholar and banker Arrighi studied the so-called long-term cycles, or he called this century cycles, systemic cycles of capital accumulations. And each such cycle is based on the specific institutional structure. For instance, during the last two centuries, we have seen the changes from the colonial type of economy, which was based on the huge world powers in Europe, British Empire, colonial empire, French Empire, Russian Empire, and so forth. Those colonial period of capital accumulation is more or less good explanations given by Marx. Mm-hmm. He showed in his papers that the main feature of this kind of economic structure is antagonistic conflict between labor and capital. This colonial period was characterized by the slave trade, by the exploitation of all over the world by the European empires, and there were no any social rights, no trade unions, nothing which could protect workers from the exploitations from the capitalists. This colonial type structure collapsed in the beginning of the 20th century. The First World War and the Second World War were provoked by the British in order to maintain their British Empire as a leader of the world. The point is that this transition period from one cycle to the another cycle usually is going on through the world wars, because the ruling elite of the leading countries do not want any changes. And at that time, 100 years ago, we have seen two world wars. Both were provoked and organized by British, and the Second World War also by the Americans, who made a huge investments in militarization on German Empire. And the idea of these two wars, designed by the British, was to have a conflict between Russia and Germany in order to prevent their development. At the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russian Empire together were in very close relations. And they produced more goods and they were more advanced. They had faster growth rates than British Empire. And it was quite clear that Russian and German Empire, together with Austrian Empire and Ottoman Empire, becomes a new center of the world. In order to prevent this formation of the new center of the world, British provoked the First World War, which destroyed all those empires, and Europe was also destroyed, and British maintained their world leadership till the Second World War. But at the same time, we have seen the Russian Socialist Revolution and the emergency of the principally new institutional structure. It was a structure based on the central planning economy, which was very new, and which demonstrated a huge growth rates. The industrialization and growth rates of not only of industrial production, but of the whole economy in the Soviet Russia was the highest in the world at that time. At the same time, in the United States, another type of this new institutional structure also emerged, based on the transnational corporations. From the organizational point of view, the Soviet system and the American system were rather similar. the basic unit in organizational structure was large corporation. In the Soviet Union, it was called ministries, which organized production in this or that industries. In the Western world, they were transnational corporations. For the first time in the history, the governments invented the fiat money, which they used in endless scale. Mm-hmm. The government, the central banks, government central banks, started to print money in those quantities which were necessary to finance investments for economic development. For the first time, we have seen that the monetary limits were overcome. There were no any problems for the finance industrialization in the Soviet Union because the state bank printed as much money as were necessary to finance the growth of productions and investments. The only limits were physical resources. At the same time, in the United States, the Federal Reserve emerged, and Federal Reserves also started to print money in those quantities which were necessary for the American government to finance its budget and to stimulate economic growth. These two principally new, but politically opposite systems, they were common in the way of organization of production, but they were opposite in the political sense. In America, we have seen democracy, in Russia, communist totalitarian state. In spite of the political antagonism, those two systems demonstrated very fast growth, especially the Soviet systems, which didn't suffer from the Great Depression. The Great Britain started to lose its hegemony again. And again, they started to provoke the New World War, again, between Russia, between Soviet Union and Germany. Finally, the war finished with the political results, which was very astonishing for the British, because the British lost the empire, in spite of the fact that they were among the winners. They lost empire because the two superpowers emerged, the Soviet Union and United States, which were much more efficient than the British colonial type state.
That's right.
These large scale corporations and ministries organized production, mass production, in much more efficient way than have been done by the private companies in the British Empire. So British Empire collapsed the so-called imperial, as we define it, imperial world order began, dominated by the two superpowers. Now this cycle comes to the end. Mm-hmm. First, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union about 30 years ago.
Yes.
Now we are looking for the collapse of the United States. The Soviet Union collapsed because the central planning economy was very rigid, and it didn't satisfy for the needs of the science and technological progress. This was very a bureaucratic system which reject innovations. And finally, the Soviet Union began to go on, down in technological competition. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the only one leader. But this leadership was not forever, because the American system today is based on the creation of the fiat capital, which has no limits. You see, according to the Arrighi studies, mm-hmm. each one-century cycle of the accumulation of capital has two phases. The first phase is material expansion. The new system of management, the new more efficient institutions give opportunity for those countries which use these institutions to become the leaders in the industrial production, in the rail sector. But after two generations, the leadership in industrial sector transfers to the leadership in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And the second half of this century is the financial expansions. Financial expansion of American capital now have such a scale that the efficiency in the rail sector simply doesn't matter. During the last 10 years, maybe 12 years, the amount of dollars in the world economy increased about four times. At the same time, we see that in China and in India emerge the new technology, a new economic system, which have much more complicated structure, which combine the central strategic planning with the market competition mechanism. The government control the money circulation through the government, through the state banking system. And at the same time, the private entrepreneurs, the private companies has access to the endless credit facilities, but they get this access only in those spheres which increase the production of the goods which have consumer demand. So this combination of central strategic planning and private markets and companies competition gives new opportunities for the economic growth. The government creates, the central bank, government central bank creates money. The government controls the circulation of this money. It's do in such a way to avoid the speculations. They give opportunity to the private companies have a long-term credits, maybe half, 0.5 interest rate, even 0.2 interest rates, which are provided by the government banks for those companies which are able to produce more goods and give more opportunities for economic growth. And the government at the same time block the speculations which undermine the economic stability. For this reason, almost all money which are created by the state are going to the rail sector. Mm-hmm. And today we see that monetization of the Chinese economy about two times higher than American economies. Almost the amount of money which were created by the Chinese state bank during the last 12 years increased about three times. But this money was not going to the financial speculations as in the United States. It was going to the production sector. And we see that Chinese corporations like Huawei, let's say, or Xiaomi, or China Construction, or Power Engineering Company, becomes the huge old corporations. They were created, especially in private sector, like Huawei or Xiaomi, they were created just from nothing, from private cooperatives, which are growing up very fast because the government support these companies with the cheap credits. But at the same time, the government control with the use of the money. It's avoid the capital flight. The currency control is very strong. The yuan, RMB, is convertible only for current transactions for trade, but it is not convertible for the capital transactions. The capital flows are controlled by the government. And all this monetary mechanism is designed in such a way to promote investments. You see, the Chinese, as well as Indian and maybe Iranian financial system, has a clear goal to finance, first of all, new investments, to finance the growth of production, which is quite different from the American and Western system, where the money are created for the needs of the financial oligarchs. They print money in huge quantities without taking care where this money are going. The main idea is to get super profits. For this reason, they create various derivatives, which in fact are pure speculative instruments. And these financial bubbles concentrate about 80% of the whole money created by the Federal Reserves. And the mechanism which we see at the moment in the West, financial mechanism, is going through the turbulence. It becomes very turbulent. Every 10 years, we have the financial crisis. And there is completely, almost no economic growth. There is no growth of the real income of the population. So American and European economy is in stagnation. At the same time, the Chinese and Indian economies are growing up very fast. So the world economy is switched to the new center in the South East Asia. We see the new world economic center, which dominates now in the world economy by the growth rates. More than 50% of the growth of the world economy is the growth in those Asian countries. This center is much more efficient. It wins economic competition. And the Pax Americana is going to the end, not because Chinese and Indian economies are growing up so fast, not because they were in miserable situation before. They are growing up very fast because they have much more efficient system of management, much more efficient institutional system. So this new type of economic organization combines the central planning for central strategic planning and private entrepreneurs. We call this type of state as integrated, integrative state, or integrated world economic mode, because the main function of the state is the combination of the interests, the harmonization of the interests of various social groups. The American-style system is designed for the needs of the financial oligarchy.
Exactly.
The American system protects property rights for the large capital, and they don't care about the workers, about the population as a whole. And for this reason, we see the huge social differentiation, which finally go into the political destabilization, which we have seen during the last presidential elections in the United States.
Exactly.
As for the new type of the state in Asia, we see the socialist ideology. We see the huge role of the moral standards. The state is responsible before the people. The main idea of the economic policy is the growth of the incomes and living standards of the population. So this combination of the socialist ideology, of the traditional values, of market mechanism and central strategic planning, government control over the money creation, shows the huge efficiency, and it is no doubt that the last part of the present century will be dominated by the competition between China and India. Unfortunately, cost about 100 million people killed in the two world wars organized by the British Empire. Now the American financial and ruling elite is trying to maintain its leadership, starting the new world war. We call this war hybrid war, because the main front lines in this war are going in the financial sector, in the economic and trade sector, in information technologies, and only the final stage, they use the military power in order to press opposition and in order to finalize the expansion in the financial and economic and information sectors. But this is the real world war, because the idea of this world war, hybrid world war, is from the American side, is to maintain its world hegemony. And they don't care about other countries.